all media. Environmental discourse in the digital age.
Okay, thanks very much, Carla. And yeah, thanks to North London branch as well for the invitation to give a talk here. So I suppose I'm going to give a slightly different perspective on the day's discussion of environment. I'm going to talk about the media, and this is obviously important because for most of us, you know, the mainstream media, the mass media, are our sole source. Well, if you're anything like me and you're not scientifically inclined, really, it's our sole source of information about environmental issues. Obviously, the media today is very complex, and it's a network of technologies and platforms that it would be completely impossible for me to sort of analyse in any comprehensive way in 20 minutes. So what I wanted to do, and I hope this is not going to be too fragmentary, is just pick out, if you like, three movements or three moments in contemporary environmental communication. And these are, and I'll number them as three things. I was always told when you give a talk you should tell people how many things you're going to discuss so that they know when you're going to shut up. So three things are the rise of envirotainment in film and TV, which is a thing, I assure you. The social media phenomenon, if you like, of Greta Thunberg, so we'll be meeting her again, and the activist aesthetics of Extinction Rebellion. And then finally, I'm going to sort of try and bring these three elements together a little bit, and you know, try and reflect a bit on the implications of these movements for the way that we as socialists communicate about the environment. Okay, there have been obviously huge changes in environmental media over the last couple of decades. Not very long ago, one of the main criticisms that people made of media coverage of ecology is that there's not very much of it. And just a decade ago, for example, there was an academic study of British TV news which complained that between 2004 and 2006, there had only been 31 stories about climate change on BBC and ITV, which is an average of only one story per channel every 3 weeks. But if you look at more recent statistics, and I don't really need to emphasise this too much, I think it's fairly obvious, news media coverage of climate change news is dramatically increasing. So in 2019, man-made climate change is not a neglected topic, nor can its scientific basis be dismissed as easily as it used to be. And we all know this, but for many years, you know, Fox News has told its American viewers that man-made climate change is a ruse devised by liberal elites to raise taxes or to destroy American productivity. And fossil fuel industry front groups like Global Climate Coalition have lobbied government and media organisations to cast doubt on the evidence for global warming. And in Britain, for example, we have the joy of Spiked magazine. It's already been mentioned by Paddy. Which has kind of ridiculed environmentalism. And actually, just to stop off on that point, because I thought it was interesting what Paddy said about Spiked, the Brendan O'Neill article, which is mocking Extinction Rebellion, he does make some very good points, I think, and I totally agree that there is this kind of maybe middle class, problematic phrase, certainly kind of moralising elements in XR. So I think we can agree with that, but we should remember that Spiked is also pretty much dedicated to climate change denial. So just as a kind of little caveat, it is funded by the Charles Koch Foundation, I think. That's what it was. That came out a couple of years ago, right? So we've had Spiked magazine. Even 10 years ago, or just over 10 years ago, Channel 4 broadcast a TV documentary called The Great Global Warming Swindle, Martin Durkin documentary, despite complaints from scientists and criticism from Ofcom. But in recent years, I think that enviroscepticism has lost some of its cultural credibility. The denial machine has certainly not stopped, but its professional operators might be finding it a bit harder to move through the gears. And public concern about ecological issues has obviously surged, and mainstream media organisations have started to update their reporting policies and practices. So, for example, in 2018, last year, the BBC told all of its journalists that they no longer had to interview enviro-sceptics in the interests of, you know, BBC balance. when they were reporting on climate stories. So that's quite a big shift, actually. A recent article about climate change denial in the US in the magazine Vice, kind of youth-oriented magazine Vice, points out that even with Trump in office, Bill spoke about this, I think, earlier, even with Trump in office, the climate denial movement, as Vice puts it, is quietly falling apart as deniers lose funding and succumb to infighting. I wouldn't want to overstate that point, actually. Maybe Vice is kind of slightly exaggerating the point, but there have been big changes, you know, in the way that, in the kind of credibility that enviro-skeptics have in mainstream media. And then at the same time, climate change awareness is taking on increasingly seductive forms. So starting in the last decade, film and TV documentaries have increasingly combined the analysis of climate science with more emotive modes of address and celebrity appeal. And I'll just name check, I mean, this is rather superficial, but I'll name check a couple of these productions. So for example, Franny Armstrong's crowd-funded docudrama The Age of Stupid, I don't know if anyone's seen it. In that, for example, actor Pete Postlethwaite plays the archivist, a man living in post-apocalypse conditions in 2055, who looks back ruefully at the catastrophic environmental behaviours and decisions of the 21st century. It should be said that these... It's become almost a convention, actually, of sci-fi these days, you know, sci-fi cinema in particular, to start with images of planetary ruin and civilizational collapse. You know, it's a bit of a cliche, but I'll mention the famous quotation from, I think it's Frederick Jameson, who says, you know, it's easier to imagine the end of human civilization than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. So this is The Age of Stupid. Surviving in a world ravaged by fire and flood, the archivist asks why human beings didn't act sooner to prevent catastrophe, pulling from his library six documentaries about various aspects of climate madness. Another famous example of envirotainment is Al Gore's surprisingly popular lecture documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, which I think everyone probably has seen. Gore's subdued lament for melting glaciers and shrinking sea ice evokes a very strong sense of loss for a disappearing global habitat. And it set the scene for more recent forays in this area. For example, the 2016 Netflix documentary Before the Flood with Leonardo DiCaprio, who goes around interviewing climate change activists from around the world. He advocates carbon taxes, a very specific solution is proposed. And he conducts an outdoor interview with Barack Obama, which became used heavily in the promotional materials for the film. Liberal commentators loved this film, Before the Flood, even before it was released. Time magazine's Candy Lang invited her readers to coo over an official White House photograph of the meeting between DiCaprio and Obama. And she describes the photograph as a very excellent photo of President Barack Obama, charming leader of the free world, and ultimate cool dad, and Leonardo DiCaprio, delightful actor, bear-fighting environmentalist, deep in a riveting conversation. So they massively hyped these productions. Obviously, for all of the hype surrounding them, all of these productions have serious limitations from a socialist perspective. An Inconvenient Truth was widely criticised, even by liberal critics, actually, who said that it was very short on solutions. And Gore, if you've seen An Inconvenient Truth, Gore is very cagey about politics. And in fact, he says... It's a bit like Extinction Rebellion today, you know, he says that climate change is an issue beyond politics. That's a common feature of lots of these types of productions. The Age of Stupid is also a very mixed bag. It's got the sci-fi premise, it's got a very frantic pace. So, I mean, it has helped, I think it did help to kind of reformat climate change awareness for a younger audience, no doubt about that. It also, it's quite radical in some ways. It condemns aspects of the airline industry. Fossil fuel corporations like Shell get it in the neck as well. But ultimately, it is less forthcoming about what action needs to be taken and certainly there's nothing on political action that needs to be taken to overcome the problem. And before the flood, the DiCaprio documentary very much failed to live up to its billing. DiCaprio gives the appearance of talking tough to Obama by adopting a sceptical expression and folding his arms determinedly. But the meeting between the two men is inconclusive, and Obama, true to form, offers little more than platitudes, really, about his hopes for change. So for all their star power and emotional appeal, none of these films really would satisfy socialists. And then along came Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg. Thunberg is not actually, I'm sure you know this, she's not actually the first young person to talk tough about environment in the assemblies of the ruling class. In 1992, the 12-year-old Severn Cullis Suzuki addressed the Rio Earth Summit, speaking in the name of all generations to come about pollution and the erosion of species diversity. But it's Thunberg who's attracted far more attention than her predecessor. And I think there's various reasons for that. One is that she's white, possibly. Speculative, but it helps. She's also been lucky in her enemies. Her conservative critics are an uncool coalition of the political right, including Spiked magazines. They're featuring strongly in this talk. Spiked magazines, increasingly tedious contrarian Brendan O'Neill, the bully boy Brexiteer Aaron Banks, and of course the climate change denier-in-chief himself, Trump. But for all the sarcasm and put-downs that Thunberg has endured, she has, and it's easy to overlook, she has actually been quite well supported by mainstream journalism. I could give many examples of this, but for example, I'll give you one. Many newspapers reported that Thunberg, for example, gave an impromptu speech in Davos in January 2019, but there is clear video evidence that of Thunberg giving that speech beforehand. So Thunberg's emergence as this kind of artless, you know, truth teller of the social media age, it has been quite carefully facilitated by sympathetic press and PR interventions. Anyway, in September of this year, Thunberg followed in DiCaprio's footsteps by meeting the Cardinal of Cool, former US President Barack Obama. Here he is again. And in a photograph of the meeting that Obama posted on his Instagram account, the former president adopts a kind of relaxed stance in an open neck and shirt sleeves, fist bumping Thunberg. You can't see, it's not this photograph here, the next one. But he's fist bumping Thunberg, and in the background is a potted plant as well, which is a nice kind of piece of added enviro credibility. And he told her, apparently, "We're a team," he said to Thunberg. Thunberg herself tweeted, and that's this image you can see on the screen, a more subdued black and white photograph of her meeting with Obama. And if you look at the composition, I mean, it's really quite odd, oddly somber kind of composition. Thunberg faces the camera, but her arms are folded, her eyes are downcast. And of course, it's a very kind of open image because you can read that in lots of different ways. I mean, it could be read as a gesture of skepticism, or displeasure. Obama appears side on with his hands folded in a selfie-facing stance, and he also seems to be lost in sort of contemplation. His eyes are fixed to the floor. So it's a cool photograph, and it's one of the most shared social media photographs of images of 2019. But of course it's very self-consciously staged as well. Black and white photography, as various critics have pointed out, has got connotations of authenticity and seriousness. And so, according to Paul Grange, photography critic, black and white has the potential for legitimation, for giving an archival aura to people and politics. So put it more simply, the photograph invites us to see this meeting as historic, a word which is, of course, you know, associated with Obama and his presidency. And Obama replied to Thunberg's tweet with a phrase borrowed from his initial presidential campaign, "Yes, we can, Greta. I'm hopeful because of you and all the young people fighting to protect the planet." So to borrow a term from Daniel Burstyn, the historian, this meeting really was a pseudo-event. It's a PR spectacle that gave a green makeover to a president who was not only one of the bloodiest political leaders of recent times, but who had a shocking record on the environment. And people forget this, but you know, Donald Trump, quite rightly, has already been critiqued in previous talks, and his dismissal of green issues is obviously atrocious. But we shouldn't forget it was Obama who was in power when the inhabitants of Flint, Michigan, drank poisoned tap water as offshore drilling was expanded and new oil pipelines were approved. And that's to say nothing of Obama's contribution to the destruction of human life with his drone assassination program. So Obama's appearances with DiCaprio and Thunberg were really another example of the former president's sham humanitarianism. And it's an oppressive feat of greenwashing, I would suggest. A triumph of what Jim McGuigan calls cool capitalism. The co-option of critique, the recuperation of rebellion, if you will. Okay, so on that note, let me move to the third movement. Nearly there, people. That I'm going to discuss, which is Extinction Rebellion. And obviously, I think most of us would agree, or maybe not, we can discuss it. Extinction Rebellion clearly are the most radical of the recent movements that we've seen around the environment. And they've been much in the news. Their spokespeople have been very successful in getting spokespeople into television news and discussion programmes. They have installed themselves remarkably quickly in public consciousness, albeit most recently because of their rather idiotic stunts on the London Underground. And I don't want to spend too much time on their kind of argumentative critiques of XR, because I think most people in this room would be in agreement with this. You know, XR probably, it's fair to say, are exaggerating their predictions of imminent civilizational collapse. I think that's already been hinted at in Bill's talk this morning. So there's a degree of exaggeration there. Of course, all of us here would say there's very little point in appealing to capitalists to fix the problems that they themselves have caused. But it is worth just briefly thinking about how successful they've managed to be with their image, in establishing their brand, if you like, through slick videos and high production values, fast-moving images of youthful crowds in urban settings, upbeat electronica soundtracks on all of their videos and all of this stuff. It's a very sort of engaging style. It's not actually a new style, and it struck me very much, and I thought, I'm sure someone else has noticed this, but I googled around to see if there was anything on it, and I couldn't see anyone who had made a connection, but it strikes me as very similar to the aesthetic style of the Kony 2012 campaign, if you remember that. We're all old in this room, actually, so yes, you know. Which aimed to engage public participation, if you remember, in securing the arrest of the Ugandan guerrilla leader, an all-round bad man, Joseph Kony. Extinction Rebellion used lurid banners, esoteric symbols, capitalised sans-serif fonts, and they encouraged their activists to engage emotionally, you know, with their cause. And all of that is very similar to what XR seem to be doing. So XR and a lot of the recent media discourse about environment seems to me to be motivating activists by promoting feelings of anxiety about the future. And their videos often move between tearful predictions of climate catastrophe and kind of upbeat scenes of determined, you know, activists. And in fact, not just the XR materials, their video materials, but I think most of the kind of case studies that I've briefly discussed so far are really heavily infused with melodrama. And it strikes me that, you know, if you want to characterise the new environmental communication sort of in terms of the style of it, it's melodrama. Melodrama, as several commentators have argued, is characterised not just by emotional outpourings, obviously, but also by stark moral binaries of good and evil, and a dialectic or movement between what the theorist Linda Williams calls too late and just in time. So you get this movement between images of too late, ruined civilizations, you know, buildings in flames and so on, and activism which is happening in just in time. So all of these features are reflected in today's media constructions of climate heroes and villains. You know, Obama versus Trump. The constant exhortation to tears, panic, and self-sacrifice that you get from XR. And the movement between imaginings of planetary destruction and manic activist urgency. So it's a kind of politics of trauma, almost, if you push it that far. It's interesting, I think a few people earlier on were talking about this, about this idea of eco-anxiety. I think Joy and Paddy have mentioned it already. This seems to be something that XR are kind of quite actively cultivating, I would suggest. Now, I don't want to push that forward as necessarily a critique or an absolute critique of XR. It's not that there's anything wrong or absolutely wrong with emotional responses. After all, we're talking about environmental collapse, and we're talking about a hugely momentous issue of climate change. And some people might even argue, I think it has been suggested in the party, that the Socialist Party itself should engage more with these kind of dynamic and emotive modes of address in its propaganda. I'm not sure I want to go down the road of talking about that now, but people might want to pick it up in the Q&A. But I think it does depend, first of all, what kinds of emotions we're talking about. And several people in the party have made this point before. I'm not at all clear that making people afraid, you know, promoting fear and anxiety about the future is necessarily a great way to encourage people to become more aware of the environmental problems that face them, or to figure out a way of overcoming them. And then, secondly, I think if socialists are to wax emotional, if we are to sort of go down the road of engaging with these kind of more emotive modes of address, I think it has to be for the right reasons. And it seems to me there's a kind of, there's a sort of mismatch between these very intense emotions that XR are all about and trying to encourage their activists to feel. There's a mismatch between those intense emotions and the subjects that they're actually prepared to talk about. If you want to be a bit pretentious, there's not an objective correlative. You know, there's a lot of emotions, but what is the object? And it seems to me XR have quite a limited understanding, not only of what needs to be done about the environment, but of what the environment actually means. So they focus on fossil fuel issues and biodiversity in particular, but and of course these are really important matters of, you know, key concern. But from a socialist point of view, human beings are part of the environment. You know, we are part of the natural world. And if we're serious about protecting the environment, then it seems to me we have to do a lot more. We have to stop the wars in which human beings are dying. We have to end hunger and starvation. And we have to stop the exploitation of human labour. So I think, as Bill said in his talk at the beginning, you know, capitalists are already making the working class pay for the cost, if you like, of the climate crisis, and that is only going to continue unless we get rid of the capitalist system itself. So the struggle over the environment, no surprises that I'm going to say this, the struggle over the environment cannot really be separated from the class struggle. And in contrast to the celebrities and activists that I've mentioned in this talk, you know, we say the only way out really is to get rid of the profit system, you know, once and for all. Okay, thank you. That's it.
Thank you.
Any questions at all? Or points of interest? Or,
yeah. My point of interest is when you look at this, when you're showing Obama with Greta Thunberg, you see the two major problems that come out. One of them, it shows the idea of the rich trying to come down to the poor, the idea of this class struggle. It's always, you can see it in the photo itself. The problem is, and as it always is since the last 100 years, has been this fighting. Everyone, environmentalists, want to see the idea of the world as this thing where they can say, oh, we will do this and everything will be okay, rather than ignoring the elephant in the room, which is class struggle, profiteering, war. if you don't get rid of those things, the same problems, environmentalism problems, keep reoccurring each time. And the other thing as well with XR, which has a very, very terrible problem, is XR is doesn't, in some ways, it's anarchist in its viewpoints, where it takes an interest in breaking everything down. Now, as an example, the leader of Extinction Rebellion believes within 10 years that the entire planet will practically collapse. We have to basically almost go back to feudalism in some of his viewpoints. And I think from an unbiased eye, you, and especially as fellow socialists here, you see that what it actually takes is not just avant-garde jumping around all over the place. What it takes is a systemic look and re-evaluation of society. And only by doing that can we, as people, as a nation, and as a world, make that decision to help people, rather than striking out on these small points, trying to look at these little profits just to claw a little bit and look like we're doing something, when we're actually, we may even solve environmentalism for capitalism in one in a trillion chance, but it doesn't solve the underlying issues for society.
Yeah, I couldn't have put it better myself. I'm not sure I can add much to that. But, I mean, to pick up on a couple of things, I mean, yeah, Roger Allen that you're talking about?
Yes.
One of the XR, you know, leaders. Yeah, I mean, some of his comments have been, you know, clearly, you know, very, very exaggerated predictions of collapse. Is it within 10 years? Is that what he said?
Yes, that's correct.
You know, it's a gross exaggeration. And, you know, I think several people in this room have said, you know, that they're going to end up with egg on their face. Some of these guys. I think one of the problems, another problem with that, with XR, is that, you know, there are many, many different voices. You talked about them being anarchist. I mean, there's very, very little direction of, in terms of, you know, what their message is.
Yeah.
And some of them haven't been as kind of pessimistic and exaggerated as Roger Hallam. Some people are much more measured voices within XR. It's difficult sometimes to know exactly what they believe, because they contradict themselves all over the shop. And I think you saw that with the action with the London Underground a couple of weeks ago, where as soon as it happened, some of the big names in XR, like Rupert Reed, I think, were saying this is a huge mistake. And you know, actually, I immediately went onto the XR website, and XR were claiming the action. So they're clearly not joined up and organised in the way that, you know, a socialist organisation, a democratic organisation, needs to be. I think first of all,
I mean, I made it often see that problem in, well, we're saying, well, it's, the problem is capitalism. But most people are saying, well, there's a problem. Always talk about socialism, nobody's telling us how we get there. We need to solve the problem now. So they're going for reforming solutions, but actually the solutions that we're offering are kind of their end result solutions without any real sense of how that pans out in real life from now till then. And so I thought, if that makes sense, that's for me, at least, how do we get around that problem? Because I feel like, for me, in conversation, that is a real problem. It's like, yeah, you keep saying all this shit, but actually we need to do something now, and you're not telling us anything about how we get there. Or not that's convincing, anyway.
Yeah, well, it's the age-old problem, isn't it, of how to speak to reformists, really. I mean, probably a number of things you'd say. I mean, one thing I would just say to that is, to people who say those sorts of things, is to point out some of the problems with the actual solutions that have been proposed by XR. For example, you know, since it's been raised already, this idea that we can reduce, you know, you can be net carbon neutral by 2025, you know, which, as people have said here, is just not feasible, it's not realistic. So, you know, you can certainly challenge XR activists on those kinds of points. But yeah, thank you.
On one of the XR demonstrations in London,
where I live,
The buses are running 2 hours late. The black cab drivers couldn't get anywhere. Basically, whilst Barcelona was in standstill, people were arriving home later than they wanted to because of the disruption. And I'm wondering whether XR sat back and assessed how much pollution was caused by the trains that took them down to London, the coaches that took them down to London, the cars that took them down to London. And I wonder if they factor in that answer, because what they did for me was score a big own goal with all the disruption they caused.
Yep, I totally agree with you. And, I mean, what else can you say, you know, to attack electric trains and stop people getting to work and probably cause a lot of probably cause a lot of workers some quite serious grief, actually.
Can I just add something just briefly? And I think one of the problems is there are groups of people around today that believe their opinion, which they believe are facts, are more important than anyone else's. And they can't abide anyone criticising them. Mm. And it's a bit like, what's that, Emma Thompson. She's come all the way from Mexico on a plane, which she hired to take there. That's a massive pollution in the sky. Mm. She's come down to get a face in the papers. And, you know, all these lovies in the theatre world and whatever, they think they're justified in telling the rest of us what to think and what to do. I think it's outrageous.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Just going back to Greta Thunberg and the media, that's what we're talking about, and how schizophrenic and polarised certainly social media has been on her. You've got the attackers with incredible misogyny, attacking her looks, attacking her as a woman, female, and then you've got her defenders, which infantilise her. She's only a child. Well, she's not a child. She's a 16-year-old young woman. So you've got this total schizophrenic media representation, and it's like, what is going on? What is going on with it? Actually, it's more social media than anything else. Mm. But it's just another way of like silencing her. And that picture, that image that we saw, again, she was the little girl, and I think she's not as small as that compared to him. I think they deliberately made him sort of towering,
doctored,
towering. And he's the daddy. He's the sort of patroniser. He's the daddy. And she's the little girl. And another way of portraying them. So again, infantilising her and making him seem very regal and understanding. Dangerous.
It's very, I mean, this is the thing, you know, there's a curious contradiction, as I was trying to get across, you know, between the way that she has been presented. I don't think it's her intention to do this, but the way she's been presented as this kind of, let's say, artless and, you know, guileless young person, and the huge kind of press and PR apparatus that has served to, it hasn't been wholly responsible for her rise to prominence, but it's been a big part of her coming to prominence. And I think you're also right about the kind of divisive nature of social media. I've noticed that as well, just sort of on an anecdotal, everyday level, it does seem to, Greta Thunberg seems to be this figure who really divides.
You're the hater or lover.
Hater or lover, and also divides along left-right lines as well. Again, this is the problem that we as socialists have in trying to get beyond both the left and the right, to try and articulate a position on someone like Greta Thunberg that is, doesn't fit with either of those worldviews. You know, we have to get beyond both of those positions.
And like you said, she's white and European.
And that always helps.
Yeah.
One other thing about Greta Thunberg, I've seen her described as mentally ill and a tool of the international left. I mean, what can you say in response to that kind of thing? I mean, apart from
Was that who was it you said? Was it China who said mentally ill? Was it?
No, I think I saw it on Yahoo Answers, which is full of complete idiotic conservative trolls. But you know, I mean, people said it.
Yeah. Okay. I think first was here.
The press and the people and the media, they think that we have a
symbiotic relationship with the Earth, you know, and somehow the Earth is ours. In fact, we're just a parasitic host which is terraformed the Earth to suit ourselves at the expense of every other living thing and chemical thing too. So I think in the bigger picture that we have to see ourselves as what we are. We don't own the Earth, you know, and when we're gone the Earth will still be here for millions and millions of years. I think in the short term we are going to exploit this, and you can draw a parallel between Brexit. The same argument of to and fro in Brexit is happening here. You know, it's going to go on. The capitalists want their last bit of petrol dollar until the sponge is squeezed dry before they go on to the... They're going to drag their feet, and we're all caught up in this media storm. So maybe XR, they aren't perfect, but they are stirring it up. They are getting people to think. And by people thinking, you may get some sort of reaction.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah,
I'll just maybe just take... was it Paddy first?
Sure, or was it George? Yeah. I just wanted to ask if anybody remembers a programme about 35 years ago about the Gaia Theory. It was a fictional series. Did anybody see it? I mean,
yeah.
But the Gaia Theory. Mike Meacher appeared on it. He made a guest appearance. It was incredibly... Sorry,
Michael Meacher.
Environment Minister.
Michael Meacher. Sorry, OK. Anyway, it's about 35 years ago. Carla's nodding, so maybe she remembers it.
I remember the guy.
And it had a massive effect amongst a certain, let's say, class of thinker at the time. I just wondered if anybody got any opinions about this guy theory, because it was incredibly appealing at the time that the Earth renewed itself, let's say.
Mother Earth was that, Mother Earth.
Well, it was about the Gaia Theory, which is what that's called.
Yes, apparently, if that's what I think, is if you don't maintain the especially cities, don't keep cities high, the nature is going to take itself. So actually, apparently, 20 years, you completely, the cities will be destroyed, all the gutters going to be blocked, and things like that. So if you evacuate a city and don't keep a city, that this is, nature is going to regain its own nature, which can be catastrophic, especially think about... all the chemicals and things that were left here, so that I don't know how to make sure you like Chernobyl. Apparently it's rigid. It's recovering itself, isn't it? In a kind of strange way as well. So I would think that's the example.
I think the guy business might have been James Lovelock.
Yes, so
who is it? Yeah.
James Lovelock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as you sort of vaguely remember the kind of Gaia trend of the 1990s, I don't know much about that as a theory.
It's just in response to what you said about recently, as far back as then, there was this very popular fictional programme on TV about the very thing.
Mm. Well, just really as a footnote, it's not such an important point, but you mentioned Michael Meacher, and it makes me realise that sort of the involvement of politicians in the environmental movement, again, is all nothing new as well. So I remember Michael Meacher at the time appearing in TV dramas that were around this idea.
That's it. That's Edge of Darkness. Thank you, Bill. That's it. That's what
it was called. So he was in Edge of Darkness as a kind of cameo appearance.
Which one is it then?
Edge of Darkness.
It's at least 35
years. It was 1986, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, these kinds of connections between politics and the media. Nothing new in this, of course. Did someone else have a question? Bill,
Well, just back to Greta Thunberg. I mean, even if she is managed, the book of her speeches is, the rhetoric is phenomenal. And the speeches she gave to the House of Parliament was a masterpiece of speech making. This is quite rare in the world today. It's certainly I think in terms of getting consciousness about ecological issues out there, the little, you know, her little white book should well be in the place of the little red one, you know, to people to wave around and give away as Christmas presents and the like, because the message in it that, you know, time is short, you know, for a 16-year-old, it's quite sober to think, yeah, by the time she's, you know, old and grey, it'll all be over, you know, not completely, but part of the shouting. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, and I mean, I was actually, when I gave the talk there, I was careful not to, I didn't want to push it too far down the road of suggesting that she's all entirely, you know, the conspiracy theory ideas that she's just a PR confection and she's been manufactured and all the rest of it. Don't want to push that too far, but really just wanted to make the point that she has got to, you know, be so prominent, partly because of quite sympathetic press and PR apparatuses. But you're right, it doesn't take anything away from the fact that, you know, her rhetoric has certainly stirred things up. It's got people talking, no question about it. I think Paddy was just first.
I just want to return to questions asked a bit ago. Tanya asked it about, what are we actually doing now about this? You know, it's all very well having this kind of perfect solution, you know, world socialism in the future. What are we actually doing about it now? And it's a question that within the SPG, you don't tend to ask ourselves, but it's a question we get a lot from people not, you know, outside, for obvious reasons. And I think we have to, at this point, say, what we, you know, what our own purpose in the party is to try and get out in front of this climate debate, because it's going in the wrong direction. It's all about making appeals to governments, which we know isn't going to work. We don't believe that capitalism can solve the climate problem. In fact, it's making it worse. We're trying to get out in front of the debate. That's absolutely what we have to do. That's our prime goal at the moment. But clearly, there's just not enough of us. We meet in still little small rooms with the bloody parades going on outside. You know, we're doing our best, but there's just not enough of us. And what we urgently need is other people to come and get involved as well. That's the only realistic thing we can say about that. Mm-hmm. We are doing everything we possibly can with what we've got available to us. Mm-hmm. We can't do more than that. And just to return very quickly to something that Kevin said earlier. Back in the early 1980s, I used to be a very popular bloke because I had a van. And one day, road protesters came up to me and said, "We want to go and protest at the camp on that's protesting against building the M65, which is a new motorway near me. Can you give us a lift over to the camp?" So I said, "Yeah, sure, I don't mind doing that, I'll take you over there. How do I get there?" And they went, "We'll just got the M65, it's a good drive." <driving." laughs>
I think the thing is, when we look at all this, the Greta Thunberg and things like this, we've also got, so when we look at things about climate change and everything, we have to take it seriously, but not to the point where it becomes absurdity. And I think that is one of the most important things. We look at Greta Thunberg, we look at these situations, and yes, I believe they are partly manufactured, but the original message there, but it's hyped up. The thing that we have to be concerned about is what we call eco-capitalism, the idea of trying to build sustainable capitalism, rather than that becoming the definition, which it is becoming, is to promote the idea that the idea of socialism is a much better form, because whether it's capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism or eco-capitalism, it's still capitalism and it's still exploitation. And that's the thing that we've got to try to avoid. So I'll leave it there.
That might always be a good point at which to wrap it
up. Just ask one question.
Yeah.
Does Greta write her own speeches? Don't we know?
I can answer that she doesn't actually write. From what I've been listening, I can't give a definitive, this is just subjective. I believe from what I've read and a few people online I've talked to, it's a little bit of it is what she wants to say, but she does have a team around her that helps her write the speeches. So she does have like her idea, and then it's, you know, interpreted through them. This is how they do it, essentially.
She was certainly she was certainly sort of picked up and assisted by a PR firm in Sweden, I think, was how it all started a couple of years ago.
The copyright on the book says just has her name, you don't have any of the authors. So, unless...
Yes, I just would like to make a comment, a very, very interesting analysing, actually, look at rebellion, revolution, or whatever, system change through the social media and how internet and how this propaganda gets on to kind of reach off every people. And I supported kind of this movement, the Extinction Rebellion, and the things is uprising, because it's a question that was left there for people actually, not actually a party itself, established party, as a kind of advertising described as a reactionism. So it's a reaction for the state quo situation that we live now, which is resulting from capitalism, exacerbated capitalism. And then it's just, and I really like this kind of the discourses I brought, and of course that to our party, we discussed as well a lot how come a movement coming from just, you know, youngsters generally and people engaged in new technology with social media and all sorts just get so much repercussion and action. And that's what I think one of the manifesto which we read is exactly to make people to think and disrupt, because to stop this absurdity of the system and the reflection that happens in everybody's lives and things. So, and I really find that interesting as well, that's this Extinction Rebellion and virtual reality and how, and I'm just like social media, all socialism, and now this, and that's the kind of comment I was just thinking on. Oh, it's just how it is and how approach the activism. That's all actually this back scenario is activism, and just let's get things done for us in a while. And I really like the discussion that it brings with different groups, anarchists, you know, communists, or whatever you call them. And as bringing the questions like how we can unify politics from all groups. And I think that's the challenge all these groups, which I think all are part of, are trying to bring together and exactly bring the good of all those little kind of those big groups and bring it to a kind of stylistic socialist standard. And I know it's very confused, nobody got the recipe, but I find that very kind of valuable and really good. What points should we have now?
Okay, shall we wrap this up now? Okay,
thank you.
Thanks very much.